I haven't added that many more slides over my sort of normal 50-minute presentation, so. As I'll jump out the window at that point.
Pleasure to introduce Ben Adcock from Simon Fraser University, and going to Purdue in the fall. He has done impressive work on a problem that has been tough for many on infinite dimensions, corporate sensing and infinite dimensions. And of course,
thank you. So I'd just like to thank Adrian for giving me this opportunity to talk and for putting on this whole program. I'm having a great time here. I've been here for about a week now. So, yes, so I'm. This is work with Anders Hansen, who's a research fellow, junior research fellow in Cambridge. And as Adrian said, this is going to be on the question of infinite dimensional compressed sensing. So, by now, compressed sensing has got a very well-developed theory in finite dimensions. And so what I'm going to present in this talk is an extension of this theory to infinite dimensional problems. And I'll, as I get into it, I'll describe sort of what I mean in that sense. So we're looking, of course, compressed sensing is a theory about how we reconstruct signals. So we're looking at the problem of reconstructing an image or a signal from a collection of its measurements. And so the main example that I'm going to think about today, and that's really sort of going to motivate everything that I do, is the MRI problem, or the mathematical model for the MRI problem. And this is going to be to recover an image F from pointwise samples of its Fourier transform, so this integral transform here. And there are some key issues about this problem that I'd like to highlight. I want to say something maybe sounds slightly controversial. I'm going to say that this problem is infinite dimensional. So the image is really a function in some function space, and we're dealing with the continuous Fourier transform. That's what we get from the MRI machine, not the discrete Fourier transform. And that's going to be important as we continue. The other key issue is that this is an instance where the sampling device is fixed. So we don't really have much freedom about the fact that the MRI machine is designed in a particular way, and what it gives are pointwise samples of the Fourier transform. So we can't really change that. We can't sample in a different way. And why I think this is quite important is, as Massimo has been describing this morning in his course on compressed sensing here, is there's been a lot of work in finite dimensional compressed sensing on how we design good measurement systems. And the key thing is measurement systems satisfying the restricted isometry property. But this is an instance where you don't have that freedom. So we really have to work with the samples that we're given, or with the sampling modality that we're given. Of course, the other reason why we want to use compressed sensing on this problem is that taking measurements is costly. We can't expect people to sit still for too long. As Emmanuel Candez said last week when he was here giving a series of lectures, one thing they find difficult with MRI is taking pictures of children who can't stay still for very long. So we really want to minimize the acquisition time here. We really want to take as few measurements as possible. Another issue as well that I won't really get into is that you can't take measurements too high in the frequency range. And that's another important issue in practice. And finally, of course, we're always going to deal with noise, maybe some other types of errors such as jitter as well. Okay, and I want to say a sort of second, maybe slightly controversial thing. And this is about, I guess, the sort of whole field of sampling theory and signal reconstruction, per se. And this is sort of a very large area. And in some senses, it can be sort of divided into two sort of spheres. One, you have a sort of theoretical side, and the other side is a computational side. And in the theoretical side here, we tend to think of signals as infinite dimensional things or objects in function spaces. And then the sort of name of the game here is to prove abstract sampling theorems. And of course, the sort of grandfather of all of this is the Shannon sampling theorem, which tells you when a signal or a function in a particular class is uniquely defined by pointwise equispace, pointwise samples of its Fourier transform. However, where sort of computations get done, what's done is we model a signal as a vector, a finite vector in a vector space. And then the idea is designing practical reconstruction algorithms. Of course, there's a very good reason for this. In computations, we can't deal with infinite amount of data. We can't really deal with infinite, with discretizing anyway. So there's a good reason for sort of living in this world when you're making algorithms. However, something I guess is sort of a little bit overlooked is that to get from this guy here, which is really the closer model of reality, to the sort of computational side, somehow a discretization is carried out, or an approximation, or some maybe some modeling or something like that. And what's not sort of really talked about so much is how the result of your algorithm here relates back to the original object. And so I'm actually relatively new to this whole area, so my background, I'm really a numerical analyst. My background is in numerical methods for differential equations. And so here I like to sort of put forward a slight analogy. I like to think of PDEs. So you can think of PDE being the infinite dimensional model, and then you have some numerical method, a finite difference, a spectral method, finite element, whatever. And so obviously you carry out some discretization, then the whole sort of question of numerical analysis is how these two guys relate to each other. So that's sort of what I want to have for signal reconstruction and infinite dimensional compressed sensing. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to develop computational reconstruction techniques for infinite dimensional signal models. So I'm going to think of signals as functions in function spaces, in fact, Hilbert spaces throughout. So the outline of this talk is going to be as follows. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about compressed sensing in finite dimensions. I'm not going to give a complete overview. I'm going to sort of recap the sort of salient bits of what I'm going to talk about later. And then what I want to talk about next is if I model a signal in a Hilbert space and I model sampling and how I'd like to reconstruct, how do I perform that reconstruction? Forgetting sparsity for the moment or anything like that. And the idea is we first want to answer that question before we can sort of introduce sparsity and subsampling and then get onto the full infinite dimensional compressed sensing framework. And so that's what I'm going to do next. And then in the final part of the talk, I want to talk about some new results on what I call asymptotic incoherence. And I'll explain about that in a little bit. Okay, so let's suppose we think of signals as vectors in a finite dimensional vector space in Cn. Let's suppose now we have two orthonormal bases of Cn, psi j and phi j, and I'm going to refer to these as the sampling and the reconstruction bases, respectively. Or I might refer to the phi j as the sparsity bases. So we're going to represent a signal f in terms of the reconstruction bases with some coefficients alpha j. And then it's going to be sampled by taking inner products with respect to the sampling bases. So if you're thinking of MRI, this is sort of analogous to the Fourier coefficients, although obviously we're in a finite dimensional vector space now. So then the reconstruction problem is from given these samples fj or some subset of them, we want to recover the coefficients alpha j in this new basis, in the reconstruction basis. Now, compressed sensing is a theory about sparsity. So what we're going to assume now is that f is k-sparse in the reconstruction basis. So in other words, it only has k non-zero entries in this basis. So we have some picture like this, and then we have its samples here, f hat j. Then the key question that really compressed sensing seeks to answer is, can we recover f using a number of samples, number of measurements, that's on the order of k, it's on the order of the sparsity? Of course, we're thinking about a situation here where k is very much less than n. K is very much less than the ambient dimension of the problem. Well, the answer turns out to be yes, and this is sort of how we go about doing this. What we can do is introduce the change of basis matrix that takes us from samples to the reconstruction basis. So in other words, the entries of this matrix are just the inner products of the sampling vectors and the reconstruction vectors. Now, one thing I want to note here is because we have orthonormal bases, this matrix here is an isometry. Then what we do in compressed sensing is we form a measurement matrix, which I'll call A. And this is an M by capital N matrix. And it's done by drawing rows of U uniformly at random. So in other words, we form this matrix A here. P omega throughout the talk is going to denote, P is going to denote a projection. P omega here is a projection onto the set of indices omega, which is a subset of indices 1 up to capital N, and is of size little m, and it's chosen uniformly at random. And then the sort of big breakthrough was to solve this L1 minimization problem here. So we apply the constraint that we have. We now obviously have an undetermined linear system, and then we do L1 minimization. So there are a number of sort of related ways in which we can analyze this convex optimization problem here. Massimo has been speaking this morning about and yesterday about the null space property and the restricted isometry property, and I'm actually going to take a slightly different approach. And throughout this talk, I'm going to talk about incoherence. So I'm going to define the incoherence of U as the maximal absolute entry of U in absolute value. Then there's a very nice paper by Candes and Yaniv Plan, which shows that for this problem, the number of samples I need, this little m here, so the number of rows I draw, needs to scale something like this. And if it does, then that ensures that with high probability I get f exactly, or I get the coefficients of f exactly from this L1 minimization problem. And the key thing here is I have little m, this is the number of samples I use, I have k, which is the sparsity, I have n times the incoherence squared, and I have a small log factor. So in other words, if n times the incoherence squared is small, then I've done what I wanted to do, which is recover f using only order k of its samples up to this log factor. And I'm going to talk more about the incoherence later, so stay tuned for that. Yes, yeah, that's a very good point, as we talked about. Yeah. Yes. So this result here says that if I take an F, So I take an F here, and I take, I draw, make one draw of omega, so I form one measurement matrix, then, provided I have this condition, with high probability I'll recover F. So there's a stronger condition which is commonly used in compressed sensing called the restricted isometry property, and that allows you to derive slightly stronger statements, or depending on your situation, much stronger statements that say, I make one draw of my measurement matrix and then I can recover every k-sparse F. So, in the sort of problem I'm thinking of today, where I have MRI and I'm trying to recover one image, it's not necessarily a huge issue, but in the type of problems Massimo was talking about this morning, you actually need the restricted isometry property. The problem with the restricted isometry property is it's more difficult to work with. The incoherence is this nice condition here where the restricted isometry property is a rather unpleasant condition on the matrix, or on the matrix U, or the matrix A, actually. Okay. So let me just give one brief example. So let's suppose U is the DFT matrix, so the matrix of the discrete Fourier transform. In this case, the incoherence is 1 over the square root of n. This is what's known as perfect incoherence. And if you plug that into this estimate here, then what you get is this. So to recover a k-sparse vector alpha, k-sparse signal f, I need a number of samples that scales like k up to a log factor. Okay, well, let's consider a very simple example. So here's a function f. It's piecewise constant on -1, 1. And in particular, you'll notice that this function is very, very sparse in Hall wavelets. So we think, and we're sort of thinking about the MRI problem, so what we want to do is recover f by subsampling from its Fourier coefficients. So these are its Fourier coefficients, just equispace samples of its Fourier transform. And this epsilon here is just the rate at which we take the with 1/2 here being the Nyquist rate. So in a sort of very loose sense, to use finite dimensional compressed sensing techniques, we sort of need to discretize. We need to somehow go from this infinite number of samples that we can draw to something that's finite and form this measurement matrix, if you like. So what's fairly standard, or what's reasonably standard here, is to, first of all, take my first n Fourier samples in a vector and form a measurement matrix by applying the discrete Fourier transform and the discrete wavelet transform. So we form this U here as the product of discrete Fourier transform and discrete wavelet transform. And then we just set up our L1 minimization problem, randomly subsample, and we solve. And here's just a very simple example of what happens. So here I've taken n to be 256, little m to be 130. So I'm using 130 Fourier samples from a range of, -256 up to 255. And I'm recovering 256 Hall wavelet coefficients. So we think because F is very, very sparse in Hall wavelets, it should be recovered exactly. I'm taking nearly half the Fourier coefficients from the range that I have. However, this is the reconstruction we get. And we see that it doesn't look particularly good. If you look at the error here, it's pretty large. So definitely, we're not recovering F exactly from this. So the reason behind this is the discretization, in the sense that we've taken. So what's happened here is that by using the discrete Fourier transform to set up this measurement matrix U, we've destroyed some of the structure of the problem, and that structure in this case is the sparsity. So the way you can see this is as follows. The inverse of the DFT matrix, takes Fourier coefficients, and what it gives you is grid values. It gives you values of a function on an equispace grid. However, this mapping is only approximate. What I mean by that is the following. Let's suppose I apply this matrix, the inverse DFT, to my vector f hat. So this, recall, is just the vector of the first n Fourier coefficients. And I'm going to call that chi of f. Now, this is not the vector of grid values of f. It's the vector of grid values of this approximation to f. And this is just the partial Fourier series of f. So what does this mean? Well, if we now go to our L1 minimization problem and we replace u by what we have and we replace f hat by chi of f, then what we get to is that we have the following constraint. What this means is that if this is going to give the correct result, if it's going to spew out the sparse vector that we want, what we require is this psi here on the right to be a sparse vector. But this can't happen. This xi here is the vector of Haar wavelet coefficients of the truncated Fourier series of f, so of this guy here. And there's a problem. Fn is just a sum of exponentials. It's just a smooth function. So it can't be sparse. It can't be sparse in the Haar wavelet basis. Haar wavelets are piecewise smooth functions. So I can't have a smooth function being sparse in a basis of piecewise smooth functions. So what's happened is I've destroyed the sparsity of the problem here. By discretizing with the discrete Fourier transform, I've ended up with something that doesn't actually have a sparse solution. Well, you could think, well, okay, I'll just throw away the discrete Fourier transform and use the continuous Fourier transform. So, in other words, what we could do now is we could form U. We're just going to take this matrix here. Now, the entries of U are just the Fourier measurements of the Haar wavelets. Okay, well, we can do that. We can set this L1 minimization up again, and we can solve it. And here's an example of this. So here I've taken a function f. It's got 5 non-zero Haar wavelet coefficients, and they're in a range 1 up to some number, 768. But I've taken nearly all of the Fourier coefficients that are in this range. So I've taken 760 Fourier coefficients. And here's the reconstruction error. So this doesn't look like f at all. This looks very, very large. If everything was right and if the theory applied, when we solve this, we should be getting f exactly, and you see we're getting a very, very large error. Yes, so f is
zero negative one.
It's on -1, 1. Yeah. So I think I picked Haar wavelets that live in here. So you're right, on 0, 1 you get it exactly, but it's zero there. Yeah. And the explanation for what's going wrong here is that another part of the structure of the problem, in a way, has been destroyed. So if I think of the infinite basis of Haar wavelets, this is an orthonormal basis for L2, for a space of square integral functions, and also the sampling basis, which is just the Fourier basis, is again an orthonormal basis. Now, if we define the infinite change of basis matrix, or the change of basis operator, this is going to be an isometry. It's going to be an operator from sequences L2z to L2n, and it's an isometry. However, there's no reason that the finite matrix un, the finite change of basis formed from the first n basis functions, needs to be an isometry. There's no guarantee in general that it will be. In fact, what you can prove in this case is that this matrix is going to be very, very far away from an isometry. In fact, if epsilon is less than 1/2, the minimal eigenvalue of this matrix un, so this finite change of basis matrix, is exponentially small in n. So we know we have an isometry. The eigenvalue should all be the minimal singular value here. The minimal singular value. If it's an isometry, then its singular value should all be one. But here we're getting something that's exponentially small. So we're very, very far away from being an isometry. So we've really destroyed this this isometric structure of the problem in a way. So just to sum up, the sort of two most obvious ways to sort of discretize this problem and apply sort of finite standard CS techniques didn't really work because we destroyed some of the structure of the problem. And so what this suggests is that we should try and maybe pursue an alternative approach, which is sort of formulate the problem in infinite dimensions and then sort of discretize it in a way that preserves this key structure. So we're going to try and preserve, obviously, the sparsity, but also try and preserve this isometric structure. And let me just skip ahead to the conclusion. So here was this example again with the Hall wavelets, and here is the new reconstruction with the infinite dimensional compressed sensing technique that I'm going to introduce in a bit. And we see here that we basically get F exactly. So we get an error recovering F of around 10 to the minus 10. And what I'd like you to notice here is that on the left-hand side, the number of samples I needed was 760, and I got a pretty poor reconstruction, whereas on the right-hand side here, I require only about 50 samples, and I basically get F perfectly. Okay, so what I want to do now is forget sparsity for a moment. So I want to first of all formulate the problem in a Hilbert space setting. And then I want to before we can sort of think about how to subsample and exploit sparsity and that kind of thing, we first need to understand how we can sample in one basis and reconstruct in another basis. So this is now nice. This is going to be deterministic sampling. And what the sort of intuition you get from that leads to the theory of compressed sensing in infinite dimensions. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been working on computing coherence of this products between wavelets and linear basis.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes out is that they are not really incoherent. How come that you expect a good result from compressed sensing on the initial
So in some sense, you are right that the coherence, you don't get tiny coherences. What I'm going to talk about in the last part of the talk is how you can get around that.
Okay.
So the coherence is not always so large that it will stop you from using compressed sensing for these problems, and I'll show a few examples of that. But you are right that the coherence can be reasonably large. However, what I'll say at the end is I'll show how you can get around that.
Yeah,
so.
In terms of the infinite dimensional the cumulative coherence should be a relevant issue.
Mm-hmm. No, it's finite. So yeah. So it's a good point, but it is finite. Okay, so let's suppose now that H is a separable Hilbert space, and we have two bases on H, two orthonormal bases. So we have a sampling basis and a reconstruction basis. So continuing our sort of example from before, the sampling basis could be the Fourier basis, the reconstruction basis could be some wavelet basis. And we're going to write our signal F as an infinite expansion in the reconstruction basis with, this should be alpha j, with some coefficients. And then the measurements of F are going to be, as I said before, the inner products of F with the respect to the sampling basis. And so the reconstruction problem, I'm going to think about now, I'm not going to think about subsampling for the moment, I'm just going to think about, given the first n samples, how can I compute some approximation to the coefficients alpha j of f with respect to this reconstruction basis. So this is just classical sampling in a way. I want to say two very obvious things. Let's suppose we have a mapping f, L that takes us from samples and gives us some approximation to the first m coefficients. So the first m Haar wavelet coefficients, for example. So here are the exact coefficients here. L is going to give us these blue dots here. And then these red dots here are all the coefficients that we're not going to approximate. So what I'm going to say is it's important that if we look at the error here, we can split the error up into a sort of regularization term and a truncation term. So this regularization term comes from the fact that we approximate the first m coefficients. We don't get them exactly in general. And the truncation term comes from the fact that we don't approximate all the Haar wavelet coefficients. And I'm going to say that, okay, it's important that this regularization term should somehow be on the order of the truncation error. So in other words, the total error that we have in here should be on the same order of the sum of these guys. And the reason why I say that is as follows. We have a signal f that we'd like to reconstruct in some basis, say a wavelet basis, and we in general we might sort of think that we have some idea that that wavelet basis is a good basis for f. So what that means is that these coefficients alpha j, the exact coefficients, they decay something like this, or they might even be sparse later. But the key thing is we know something about this tail here, the truncation error. So what's important is that when we do our reconstruction with this mapping L, we don't somehow get this very, very large error in the regularization. Otherwise, we've lost all the sort of beneficial properties of reconstructing in this wavelet basis, for example. And of course, the other consideration as well is we need to have numerical stability. We need to have a small condition number in this mapping. And of course, because of the effect of noise, Randolph, etc. Okay, well, the most obvious thing to do is formulate the reconstruction problem as an infinite system of equations. So we can just write this down. If alpha, this here, alpha 1, alpha 2, is the infinite vector of coefficients, this is the infinite vector of samples, and this is this change of basis operator that we had before. So what you can see is, okay, well, the question of how do we get some approximation of the first m coefficients is equivalent to how do we, in a way, discretize this operator u? And as I said, this operator u is bounded, it's invertible, it's also an isometry, and that was the key structure property. And we'd like to discretize in a way that preserves this structure. As I showed a few minutes ago, if you don't preserve this sort of isometric structure or approximately preserve it, then you run into problems. Well, the sort of question of let me now write Pn to be the orthogonal projection on little L2. So it's going to take some infinite sequence and it just takes the first n entries and sets everything else to zero. So the most obvious thing you might think to do to discretize this operator u is to take its finite section. So just take the first n by n leading entries of u. The problem is as I showed a few minutes ago, there's no reason in general this will be an isometry. So in finite sections have been quite extensively studied in spectral theory, and it's well known that a sequence of finite sections of an operator may have wildly different spectral properties. Their spectra may look nothing like those of the original operator. So this is not a good way to proceed in general. However, very minor modifications give you something that's much better. So rather than taking a square leading submatrix of U, we take a rectangular submatrix. So we're going to take a tall and skinny submatrix. And this is what's sometimes called an uneven section. And the key thing is that this uneven section will be an isometry in the limit n tends to infinity for fixed m. So as the height tends to infinity for fixed width, I will have an isometry.
As soon as you map the small space into the big space, you are technically embedding it more and more automatically.
Yes. Yeah. So. Yeah. So this is if you're thinking of, say, Hall wavelets and Fourier sampling, this is the fact that the Fourier projections converge strongly on a fine. They converge strongly. So.
And you put it by taking the transport basically moving the.
Yeah. So, then a very simple idea to recover F or recover the coefficients of F is just to use this uneven section. So, in other words, we essentially just do a least squares set. So I've written this in terms of the normal equations. So what we're doing is we're computing alpha 1 tilde up to alpha m tilde by just doing a least squares. And then we have this is what we sort of call generalized sampling. We have a very simple theorem. If this matrix U is an isometry, then for each m, so m here is the number of coefficients I want to compute, there's an n naught such that this alpha tilde exists uniquely for all n greater or equal to n naught. We also have this sharp bound for the error. So the norm, alpha minus alpha tilde, is less than or equal to this constant times by the norm of alpha minus its projection. So this bound here is really a statement of quasi-optimality. So it says that the total error in this can't be too much bigger than the error of basically knowing the first m coefficients exactly. The key thing here is this constant, which I'll talk about more in a moment. It involves this parameter CNM, which is this guy here. So here's this CNM. What this guy does is it measures how close this uneven section is to being an isometry. So this guy here is the uneven section composed with its transpose, or its adjoint. And this is just the PM, the projection. So in other words, if I fix M and I let N, so the height of this uneven section, tend to infinity, then this constant is going to tend to zero. So I can make it I can make this 1 over the square root of 1 minus CNM arbitrary close to 1. Of course, because an isometry is nice and stable, this means that the mapping, this L, that takes me to the coefficients is also, its stability will be determined by the same factor as well. So let me just make a key point. What this means in practice is that I take an M and the number of coefficients I want to reconstruct, and I take N to be sufficiently large. N is the number of samples I use here. So what this means is I'm going to reconstruct fewer coefficients in the reconstruction basis than samples I have. Sounds like a very crazy thing to do. I'll explain why it's not in a moment. So one other thing I want to mention is, okay, this theorem here is fine, but what it relies on is, of course, taking an M and then taking N sufficiently large. So you might ask the question, well, how large do I need this N to be? So given an M, a number of coefficients I want to reconstruct, how big do I need, how many samples do I need to take? So what I introduce here is this thing called the stable sampling rate. And this is a quantity theta, which is a function of M and some parameter little theta here. And what this says is the following. It says, given an M, if I sample at a rate N, so I take a number of samples N that's greater than or equal to capital theta, then what I guarantee a priori is that I have existence and uniqueness of my reconstruction. I also have well conditioning of the reconstruction, and I also have quasi-optimality. So I get this guaranteed error bound. So you might say, well, okay, that's a nice name for something, but you still really haven't answered the question of how large I need N to be. One nice thing about this is that you can always compute it. So the CNM here is just some norm of a matrix. Or really just proportional to a singular value. So you can always compute this stable sampling rate. You can always determine a priori conditions under which your reconstruction will be stable and quasi-optimal. Having said that, a lot of what we've invested effort into doing is to proving analytic bounds for this kind of thing, for the stable sampling rate. These completely depend on the type of sampling system and the type of reconstruction system. So it's nice in a way that it leads to an infinite number of problems. So you can take a sampling basis and a reconstruction basis and try and compute or determine the stable sampling rate. I've just put some results here of ones we've derived. So for example, for essentially any wavelet basis, the stable sampling rate is linear. Okay, and for polynomials, it's essentially quadratic. Oh, sorry, it is quadratic. Yes.
So the we are talking about right now, if I understand, n, capital N is the number of conditions you take, let's say, in the sample size.
Yep.
And n is the number, the first n coefficients of the sequence of the alpha.
Yep. Yeah. You're just trying to understand when you can stably map samples to coefficients and what is the relative dimensionality. Yeah. So, yes.
Are you assuming certain ordering
there's
some
data, or is it from one basis? Yes. So it's a good question. So you do need an order. You impose an order because I'm thinking of, yeah, I naturally give an order to everything. So things can change if you change the order. It'll probably, it will probably just change the constant. I mean, when you have wavelets, I mean, you're thinking of scales anyway. So when you have wavelets, this is M is, you know, normally going to be a power of 2. So I don't think it will really change that much because this is convergence in L2. So I know there are theorems if you rearrange wavelet coefficients and sum them up in a different order, then you can have divergence, but that's not when you're looking in L2. Okay, so let me just give an example of this. So here's a piecewise smooth function, and I've taken 128 Fourier coefficients, and, well, of course, this is what would happen if you were just to sum up the Fourier series of this function. Of course, what you see here is we see this sort of Gibbs phenomenon here. So this is not a very good way of reconstructing a piecewise smooth signal. But, of course, what we can do is we can just reconstruct it in a different basis. So here I've taken the first 64 Hall wavelets, and this is the reconstruction I get using this generalized sampling, and this is the error here on the right. So immediately we see, okay, we get a nice tenfold decrease in the error over Fourier sampling. The key thing I want to point out here is that this constant C and M is around 1/2, and you get that by taking this M here to be smaller than the number of Fourier coefficients N. Of course, we know that this F is nice and piecewise smooth, so I could take polynomials on the interval 1/2 up to 1, and I get a very dramatic reduction in the error there because, of course, F is very, very nicely approximated by polynomials. And so you see now the error is around 10 to the minus 10. The key point again here is that with 128 Fourier coefficients, I recover only 13 polynomial coefficients, but that's to ensure that I get boundedness at this constant, so I get nice stability. Yes? It's a good question. So you need to have some idea about what basis you want to use. And in general, for general images, this can be a difficult question. This is a question that people have looked into for years. But the idea is, okay, suppose I actually do know a basis that I want to use. So I, some wavelet basis or whatever, then how do I go about reconstructing it? So I'm not trying to answer the question of necessarily which basis do you choose. So that's a different question, and it's a hard question as well. So let me just show this importance of following the stable sampling rate here. Suppose we let M be equal to N. So we take a finite section now, and we do the same thing. These are the reconstructions we get. So this is with Haar wavelets. This is with polynomials. So we see we get a very, very poor reconstruction. Even though here we're recovering in both cases, we're actually computing more coefficients in the reconstruction basis, we get a worse reconstruction. One thing I would like to say as well. So this is just, this is just plain vanilla classical stuff in a way. Yeah. So this is, even if we use a finite section, we get a worse reconstruction. If we add a bit of noise, it gets a lot worse. It's very, very unstable. However, even with noise, if you go at the stable sampling rate, you still get a very nice reconstruction. One thing I would like to say, you might be asking at this point, is this something fundamental? This stable sampling rate that I've introduced, does it tell you something about, as Massimo was saying, the relative dimensionality that I can have? So if I have M coefficients that I want to reconstruct, how many samples do I need asymptotically? And this is a difficult question. We have a result in one specific instance that says, actually, yes, this is a fundamental issue. So it's in the case of polynomials. In the polynomials, you can't get away with a lower scaling than quadratic. Okay, so that was this is our what I just described there was how you recover signals. We didn't assume any sparsity, and the key idea was to use a stable sampling rate and overdetermine. But now we'd like to take advantage of sparsity, and this is where we're going to get the generalization to infinite dimensional compressed sensing. So let's suppose now that we have F, it's in our Hilbert space, but it's actually k-sparse. So in other words, if these are Haar wavelets, for example, its expansion is now finite. We only have a finite number of non-zero coefficients, and only k of those are non-zero. And so capital M now is going to denote the largest index of a non-zero coefficient, alpha j, and k is now the sparsity. So of course, if we want to recover F from, say, its Fourier samples, we could just use generalized sampling, just set up and solve our least squares problem, but of course we need a number of samples that will scale will be at least M. So we need to go at this stable sampling rate. So the question is, how can we take advantage of the sparsity? So let me just clarify some notation here before I go on. K, as I said, is the sparsity. Capital M is the range of non-zero coefficients of F now in the reconstruction basis. Little m is the total number of samples that we want to use. So this is the guy that we want to be on the order of K. Capital N is going to be the range of indices from which we draw these M samples. Remember, we're going to draw samples randomly, and this is going to be done by capital omega. So it's capital omega is a subset of indices 1 up to N, and it has cardinality little m. And it's going to be chosen uniformly at random. So I'm going to define the coherence as well of this change of basis operator, much like one would do in the finite dimensional setting. It's now the supremum of these entries in absolute value. It's finite. Okay. yeah. So what you can do is you can set up this as a convex optimization, infinite dimensional convex optimization problem. Then the question is, how do we discretize this? How do we preserve the isometry property and the sparsity? And the key idea is to now take an uneven section, and then subsample from it. So in other words, we're going to use this constraint now. And what we have here is we have P omega, so this is our random projection. We have U and we have PM. So what we're really doing is we're first of all taking a tall uneven section of U, and then we're subsampling randomly from the rows. So if, for example, this was our tall uneven section of U, so here it's 8 by 6, then we subsample from the rows with little m. We take four rows here. We have a sparsity of 3, for example, so that's what we're doing. So the key thing is we use this uneven section and we randomly select rows of that. Well, of course, a few moments ago I introduced a stable sampling rate. It tells you how tall to take this uneven section. We need exactly the same thing here when we're doing random subsampling as well. And so what we like to call this is the idea of a balancing property. So if I'm given an M, so that's the range of non-zero samples, K is the sparsity, then I'm going to say capital N and little m satisfy the weak balancing property with respect to capital M and K if these two conditions here hold. These look rather unpleasant. Let me say the first one here, of course, this is a measure of how far the uneven section is from being an isometry. And the second condition here is some control we need on randomly choosing subsets of index K. I didn't say what this MR norm here is. This is the maximal row norm of an operator. Maybe I should just... So this is... So if B here is an operator on L2. This second condition looks rather unpleasant. Actually, you can replace it by a stronger condition, which is sort of more simple to understand, at least. This is the uneven section composed with its adjoint. This is its diagonal part. So what we're asking is that it's not too far from its diagonal part. And of course, if it were an isometry, then this would be zero. So this is the first theorem. So we're solving this L1 minimization problem, and the theorem is as follows. If U is an isometry, and epsilon we take greater than zero, and if capital N and little m satisfy the weak balancing property, and if this little m here is chosen like this, then with high probability greater than 1 minus epsilon, there's a unique solution of this problem, and it coincides with the exact vector alpha. So in other words, we'll recover any K sparse F exactly by doing this L1 minimization. And so the nice thing about this is it generalizes this Candazin plan result to this infinite dimensional setting. In fact, their result pops out as a corollary of this. Let me say here the key point is that we have M, little m, the number of samples that we take. We have capital K, little k here, which is the sparsity, so that's good. We have n times this incoherence, which I'm going to talk more about later. So we are getting what we want, provided this guy is reasonably small. And that's going to be the subject of the last part of the talk. So here's this example again that I gave at the start of the talk. As I said, this is this 5 sparse vector in Haar wavelets. This is the reconstruction using this finite section. This is the reconstruction we get with the uneven section. And here we use 50 samples, so we get basically perfect recovery. And again, what you see here is the importance of this balancing property. If you don't follow the balancing property, then you can get disastrously bad results. Okay, well, yes. That's going to be this. Yeah. No, that's I think I call that quasi-optimality, but that's in general. So when I have obviously when I have something that's actually sparse, then I hope to get it exactly. I hope to have no truncation error, because it's. Yeah. So this holds now for if I have a signal that is exactly sparse, but of course in practice we don't have something that's exactly sparse. And so what you see in the standard compressed sensing results is theorems that handle what are called compressible signals. So I'm going to define this set here, sigma km. This is going to be the set of alphas. So alpha is this infinite sequence of coefficients, and these are coefficients that are coefficient vectors that are sparse. All their non-zero entries lie in indices 1 up to m, and they have at most k non-zero entries. And I'm going to define this this distance here, this error. This is going to be the L1 norm error. The best L1 norm, the error in approximating some arbitrary alpha by an element of this space here. So if alpha was actually sparse, then of course this would be zero, but in general it's not going to be. So of course, if we're going to apply compressed sensing, what we'd like is some theorem that says that when we do this, we're going to recover f exactly up to some order that's on the order of, up to some error that's on the order of this sigma km of alpha. Well, in the compressible case, we need a slightly different balancing property, what we call the strong balancing property. It's basically the same. The first condition is the same, but we need a slightly stronger condition here. And we can again replace this with something that looks a little nicer. And then the theorem is as follows. If we set up our L1 minimization problem, then if we're given an epsilon greater than naught, and we're given capital M and little k, and if capital N and little m satisfy the strong balancing property, and also we have this condition here, then with high probability, any minimizer of this problem here will satisfy this estimate. So the norm of alpha minus beta, this is the little L2 norm here, is bounded by some constant times by this sigma km. So I'm going to recover f or alpha exactly up to its best approximation by a sparse signal.
So I take an isometry, and
yep.
I know that for n going to infinity, the left-hand side of u1 goes to 0.
Yep.
The right-hand side tells, however, that it has to go to 0 with a certain speed. Right? So as soon as n goes to infinity, the right-hand side goes to 0, like 1 over square root of logarithm.
Yes, but I can choose m as well. So I can make m sufficiently large as well. So, yeah, you are right that if, you know, I have little m as well to play with. So yes, it's true that if m was fixed, there might not be an n such that held.
But
I can.
Balance of n over m.
Yeah. So. Okay. And here's an example for a compressible signal. So f here is a sum of 200 Hall wavelets plus some guy that's small in norm. So this is sort of compressible, it's sparse, plus something that's relatively small in norm. And here's the error. So the left-hand side here, this is capital N. This is just the error by summing up the Fourier series. Of course, this is pretty bad. This is the error here if we just did standard generalized sampling. We didn't assume any sparsity. And we see we get around 10 to the minus 5 error. This here is the error if we do generalized sampling and compressed sensing. And what we see is that we get basically the same error here, but the key point is this little m. This is the total number of samples we use now. And so in the third column here, we use 230 samples. In the middle column here, we use 601. And then on the bottom row, we use 460 and 1201. So we're getting away with around one-third of the total number of samples and still getting the same error. Okay, so that was what I just presented now was a theory of compressed sensing in infinite dimensions. And what I want to spend the rest of the talk discussing is this incoherence. So as I've already hinted at, and as Massimo said a little bit earlier, we have this estimate here, and this is the key estimate, and it tells us how many samples that we need to use. And the key thing here is these two factors, this n. So this is the range in which we draw our little n samples, and this incoherence. Oh, sorry, the coherence parameter. Now this is a problem, or it can be a problem. So if this factor is large, what this says is that we need to take little m really large. So in fact, if you go back to the theorem, all the theorems have this little bit at the bottom that says if you have little m equal to capital N, then everything works out. So if this product here is too large, then we can't use it. It doesn't actually tell us that we can do any subsampling. And this can happen in two ways. First of all, you can have a coherence that's order one, and this incoherence here is some fixed quantity. So you can sort of, in a way, think of this as being sort of being given. We could have that mu, say, was very small, say 10 to the minus 4 or whatever, but we could have this capital N being large. Now, capital N is defined, it's basically determined through the balancing property. So it basically depends on this capital M here. And this is the range in which our samples exist. So if we have a signal that's sparse, but its non-zero entries are spread out, are very, very far spread out, then it can well be the case that this product is very large here. And then what the theorems tell us is that we will actually need to take a very, very large number of samples. So here's a very simple example. Here's a function. Looks like this. It's a very contrived example. And what I'm taking as my reconstruction basis is a basis of orthonormal polynomials on minus 1, 1, so Legendre polynomials. And here are the Legendre polynomial coefficients of this function. And what we see is the first 100 of these are large. That follows from this 100 factor here. And then the rest are very, very small. And the reason behind this is because we have an oscillation of frequency 100, but other than that, F is smooth. So this is F is sparse in this basis in a sense, but we have a large range of the non-zero coefficients essentially. And also, in this case, we have the incoherence, the coherence being one. The reason why the coherence is one in this case is it's because we have the function 1 in both our Fourier and our Legendre polynomial basis. But even if we were to take that out of one of the bases, we'd still have the incoherence being fairly large. And what this means is that if we do random subsampling, this is the kind of error we get. We get a pretty large error. So here I've used I've used samples from range 1 up to 1001, and I've taken 370 samples. So I've taken a fairly large number of samples, and I still get a pretty bad error. However, if you take this U and you look at the entries of this infinite matrix, what you see is you see a plot along of something like this. So the darker bits here are entries that are large, and the lighter spots are entries that are close to zero. And so what we see here is the overall incoherence is one, and actually the large entries are near the top of the matrix, and then they go along this diagonal. Once I get off this diagonal, then the entries decrease reasonably rapidly. And in here, they're actually very, very small. Incidentally, the slope of this line is pi, or 1 over pi. And actually, what you can show for this matrix is that you have a property which we like to call asymptotic incoherence. And what this means is the following. If I look at the sections of U, and I cut off the first n rows here, and if I look at the coherence of the remainder, then this decreases as I increase n. So as I go farther down this matrix, I have a decreasing coherence. And in fact, what you can show in this case is that the coherence decreases like n to the minus 1/3. So what this suggests is actually a fairly simple idea. It's not ours, other people have employed it in the past, is that rather than subsampling and doing random subsampling, what we're going to try and do is sample fully in the coherent regions of U, try and pick up everything there, and then subsample in the relatively incoherent regions. And so this is the setup. Let's suppose now that we have, I'm going to introduce this delta. This is the support essentially of alpha, the coefficients of our sparse vector, or our sparse signal, and let me assume it's supported on 1 up to n, and we have k sparsity. Now we have a slightly different weak balancing property. If m, capital M, and little k are given, then I'm going to say capital N1, capital N2, and little m satisfy the weak balancing property with respect to capital M and k if the following two conditions here hold. So again, we have this this measure of how far the uneven section is from being an isometry. We have some nasty looking thing on the right-hand side, and then we have this guy here. Again, this can be replaced with something a little bit nicer. Now what we do is the following. Given capital M and K, we're going to pick N1, N2, and M, obeying this weak balancing property, and then we're going to form omega. Omega is, remember, the set of indices that we're going to take our samples from. And we're going to take omega 1 to be all the indices 1 up to capital N1, and omega 2 to be essentially chosen. It's going to be a randomly chosen subset of indices N1 plus 1 up to N2, and it's going to be a size little m. And then what you can show is the following. If we have epsilon greater than naught, capital N1 and N2 and little m satisfy the weak balancing property, and little m obeys this inequality here, then if we do L1 minimization, we'll recover f, any k sparse f, exactly with high probability. And the key thing to realize here is the following. In this estimate now, we now, instead of n times the incoherence of u squared, we have this n2, essentially n2 minus n1, times by the incoherence of this tail operator. So what this means is that I can take n1 large so that this guy starts to be reasonably small, and then I can get a smaller bound here for m. So here's an example. It's the same example again. Remember, this was the reconstruction we got with random subsampling. Here's the reconstruction we get with semi-random sampling. So here I've taken the same number of samples, but I've taken n1 to be 170 and N2 to be 1001 again. So I've taken the same number of samples, I've taken them from exactly the same range, but I've got a dramatic difference in the error. Here the error is order 1, here it is 10 to the minus 9. So here I'm essentially getting F exactly. And it's all because of, rather than doing complete random sampling, we did some deterministic sampling in this coherent region. Let me say something as well. This is not this talk has mainly been about infinite dimensional compressed sensing, but the coherence is an issue of it also in finite dimensions. So if I had a finite dimensional problem now, so where U was now an M by N matrix, you might have a standard, an estimate of this kind of form for the number of samples. So you again see here this N times by the incoherence of U squared. And as I said earlier in the talk, if you have if U is the DFT matrix, or if it's a random Gaussian or something like that, then you get what's known as perfect incoherence, and then the number of samples you need scales like the sparsity. However, that need not be the case in general, and you can, if you have something like asymptotic incoherence in finite dimensions, then you can do exactly the same semi-random sampling. And people have done that as well. So I want to say something else, though. What's often referred to as perfect incoherence is this property here. The number of samples I need needs to grow on the order of k up to some log factor. And so in the literature, you see this referred to as perfect incoherence. And so I have this sort of theorem here in inverted commas. In infinite dimensions, if you reconstruct in wavelets and you do semi-random sampling, then you essentially have perfect incoherence. And what I mean by that is that given M and little k, you can pick N1 and N2 scaling linearly with M, and then the number of this little m here, the number of extra samples you need, scales like k. So you completely get rid of this factor here involving the incoherence. And I mean, this can be turned into a proof under some conditions, and it relies on two observations. The first one is that for any wavelet basis, essentially, this asymptotic incoherence or the coherence goes down like n to the minus 1/2. So that means when I substitute it into here, I've got N2 minus N1 times by 1 over N1 to the half squared. And so if I let M1 scale with N2, then I can cancel this guy out. And then the other key fact is that you need something that says the stable sampling rate is linear in M. And you can prove that as well. And this is to ensure that you get the balancing property with the right kind of scaling. Okay, so this is just going to be my last slide, or my penultimate slide. So here's an example with wavelets. I've taken a function in minus 1/2, 1/2. It's a sum of some wavelet coefficients, whole wavelet coefficients, and some extra bit here, so it's not exactly sparse. But these Haar wavelet coefficients are quite spread out. They range from 1 up to around 800, and there are 70 of them that are non-zero. This is the error that one would get if you just did random subsampling with a range N1451 and little m being 560 samples. And here's the error you get if you do semi-random subsampling. And you see that you get a pretty dramatic reduction in the error here. So let me finish there. Let me just give some references. Generalized sampling, we have a few papers on this. A nice extension to some inverse nil pose problems here. And then we have one big paper on infinite dimensional compressed sensing and some stuff as well on asymptotic incoherence. Okay, so thank you. Yes. So, okay. So, N2 is the total height I'm going to take. So here maybe it's 1 up to 100. So that's N2. Then N1 is the point at which I cut across here. So if I take, say, N1 to be, I don't know, here, then I know what's important is that the coherence that I have in all these entries below that. Yeah, so as long as the entries below N1 are fairly light, so. Yeah.
So the random sampling is really, you start with the two bases, you compute your view, you can then choose N1 and N2. It doesn't have anything really to do with the signal.
No. Yeah, so that's a good point here. So these N1 and N2 here, are not dependent on F per se. I mean, there is a dependence in the sense that they have to satisfy the weak balancing property, and that depends on capital M and K, which is, you know, what we're saying is F is K sparse, and its entries are in the range 1 up to M, but there's no dependence on F itself. What is missing? Well, first thing you'll see that none of the theorems involve noise, but that's a theoretical challenge, more than I would. It's a matter of working out the mathematics for it, but it's not simple. I think another issue as well is actually how you form this matrix U. So to form U, I've got to take inner products of wavelets and, say, Fourier data. I've got to take Fourier coefficients of wavelets. So, you know, sometimes they're known explicitly. Hopefully one can compute them fairly accurately. But what you can't do is use the discrete wavelet transform, the discrete Fourier transform, as I said at the start of the talk, because then you end up with some bad approximation to the matrix. So that's an issue that has to be sorted out. So, not sorted out. It's an issue that some care has to be taken over. But I don't think it's a completely insurmountable problem. So.
Other question, could you look at results to better than beta? I think you use beta, but they're kind of like limited depends. You want more beta.
So what do you mean?
Frames.
Good question. So we were talking about this at lunch.